KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's hard for me to believe that targets and timing and weapons would not have been classified.
Senators grilled top national security officials after sensitive military information was accidentally shared with a journalist.
It's Tuesday, March 25th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, faces questions from senators today over his nomination to be ambassador to Israel.
Have you previously supported the idea of annexation of the West Bank?
I have previously supported it, but it would not be my prerogative to make that the policy of the president.
Also, what makes marijuana smell distinctive? There are so many scent profiles now.
I'm almost 70 years old. The cannabis I smelled when I was 15 smelled way skunkier.
And we preview the NCAA Women's Sweet 16 after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump is defending his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, following the inadvertent inclusion of a journalist in a messaging app group about a U.S. attack on Yemen. Trump also repeating assertions no classified information was involved. Two Trump intelligence officials who were part of that chat appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee this morning for a hearing on worldwide threats. Virginia Democrat Mark Warner sits on the committee and in an interview with NPR says the security lapse is not a trivial matter.
Because if it had gotten out, Americans could have died in terms of the Houthis being able to reconfigure or redirect their defensive capabilities. This is kind of security 101. If this had been a military officer or a CIA case officer, they would be fired.
Warner has called for the release of all the material from the chat if indeed it is not classified. Mike Waltz, for his part, slammed The Atlantic and the media over their focus on the matter. A federal judge is ordering the Trump administration to back off its pursuit of a Columbia University student who participated in pro-Palestinian protests. NPR's Adrian Felito reports immigration agents have been trying to arrest her for weeks.
Yunseo Chung is a 21-year-old South Korean national who's lived in the U.S. since she was seven. She's a legal permanent resident. On March 5th, she was one of several students that New York police arrested at a pro-Palestinian sit-in protest at a campus building. She was cited and let go. Her lawyers say that days later, ICE agents showed up at her parents' house looking for her. Officials said her green card had been revoked. A few days after that, federal agents searched her Columbia dorm room. Chung sued in New York federal court to block the government from arresting or deporting her. She says she's being targeted for her activism. Now a judge has temporarily granted Chung's request while she fights the government's case against her. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Vice President J.D. Vance says he will also visit Greenland this week, along with his wife, Usha Vance. The second lady was previously set to pay a cultural visit to the strategically located territory, with plans to attend the national dog sled race. But now the Vances will meet instead with service members at a U.S. base on the island, NPR's Deepa Shivram reports.
Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark. In a White House video, the vice president says he will look into, quote, security at the U.S. Space Force base there.
A lot of other countries have threatened Greenland, have threatened to use its territories and its waterways to threaten the United States, to threaten Canada, and of course to threaten the people of Greenland. So we're going to check out how things are going there.
Greenlandic leaders were already expressing concern that National Security Advisor Mike Waltz would travel to Greenland later this week, as President Trump has ramped up rhetoric of wanting to annex the island. Deepa Shivram, NPR News, the White House.
Stocks followed up one of their best trading days of the year with modest gains. The Dow rose 4 points today. The S&P 500 was up 9 points. You're listening to NPR. Sales of Tesla electric vehicles have been sliding because of the actions taken by CEO Elon Musk in his role as head of the Trump administration's Doge team. That seems to be especially true in Europe, where President Trump continues to disparage many of the U.S.'s longtime allies. Tesla posted its first annual sales drop in more than a dozen years in January, and European sales have reportedly tumbled 49% in just the first 2 months of this year. Playboy Cardi has the number one album in the country. NPR's Hazel Sills reports the Atlanta rapper's third record comes after years of delays.
Playboy Cardi has been teasing his third album, titled Music, for years now. This week, the album debuts at number one on the Billboard Albums chart, the rapper's second album to do so. The album has had the biggest week for a rap album in 2025, and it marks the biggest streaming week for an album since Taylor Swift released The Tortured Poets Department last year. Playboi Carti also has two songs in the top 20, Evil Jordan and Rather Lie, featuring The Weeknd. Hazel Sills, NPR News.
Robotaxi company Waymo says it's adding Washington, D.C. to its list of cities where it's pioneering the latest technology that will be another year before actual driverless taxis are on the street. For now, the company's robotaxis are mapping D.C. streets and corridors with a driver sitting behind the wheel. Waymo's robotaxis are already providing service in Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Austin, Texas. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. America's top intelligence officials were on Capitol Hill today for a pre-planned hearing on global threats. The hearing comes after news broke yesterday that senior U.S. security officials discussed secret war plans for a military strike in a group chat on a publicly available messaging app. And in a major security breach, a journalist was included in that chat. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering all of this and joins us now. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, before we get into today's hearing, just remind us who exactly was in that group chat and what were they talking about?
Right. So this all stems from the story that broke yesterday. The editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, said that he was invited by Trump National Security Advisor Mike Waltz into a group chat on the messaging app Signal. The chat was about Yemen. The other members in this group chat were really a who's who of senior national security officials. We're talking the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, among others. And they reportedly discussed the strategy, the targets, weapons, and timing of airstrikes that the U.S. ultimately carried out this month against the Houthis in Yemen. Now, two other officials who were in that chat are the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, and the CIA Director, John Ratcliffe. And they both just happened to have a hearing scheduled for today before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Right, which is where this whole group chat fiasco was a major topic of discussion. So what did lawmakers have to say about it?
Well, Republican senators actually didn't ask about it at all in the public hearing, but Democrats absolutely grilled Gabbard and Ratcliffe on this. Democratic lawmakers called the actions of Trump's national security team here dangerous, incompetent, reckless, and they said that it could have had serious real-world consequences. Here's the top Democrat on the panel, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia.
This was not only sloppy, it not only violated all procedures, but if this information had gotten out, American lives could have been lost.
Now, Warner said that's because the Houthis could have moved their air defenses or repositioned them if they'd had this info and then threatened American aircraft.
Absolutely. Okay, well, what did Gabbard and Ratcliffe have to say for themselves?
Well, Gabbard at first wouldn't even acknowledge that she was in the group chat. Ratcliffe, for his part, did acknowledge that right away. He said that he was in the chat, but he tried to downplay the gravity of the situation. He said the government officials are allowed to use Signal to communicate and coordinate for work. At the same time, I will say that our colleague, Tom Bowman, is reporting that the Pentagon warned a week ago against using Signal, even for unclassified information. Mm-hmm. Now, Ratcliffe and Gabbard both repeatedly said at the hearing today that none of the information was classified in this group chat, but lawmakers were very, very skeptical of that. Here's Senator Angus King, an independent from Maine.
And if that's the case, please release that whole text stream so that the public can have a view of what actually transpired on this discussion. It's hard for me to believe that targets and timing and weapons would not have been classified.
Now, questions about that specific information there, Ratcliffe directed actually to the Secretary of Defense, who was not at the hearing. But Ratcliffe did at one point acknowledge that those sorts of things should only be discussed on classified channels. And look, the government does have its own secure communication systems for these sorts of things. Now, the FBI Director Kash Patel was at this hearing as well. Democrats asked him whether the FBI is investigating this breach, and Patel said that he didn't have any update on that.
Okay, so what happens next at this point? Anything?
Well, the administration is very much trying to say that this is all much ado about nothing. But I will say the information discussed in the chat is exactly the sort of intelligence a sophisticated adversary like Russia or China would want on the U.S., and the officials in the chat are all top of the target list of foreign intelligence services. Now, as for what's next, Democrats on the Intelligence Committee made this clear today that they want to get to the bottom of it, and they have very much vowed to get to the end of this.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
And we'll note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr is chair of the board of Signal Foundation, which runs the Signal messaging app.
As Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza heats up again, President Trump's pick to be U.S. ambassador to Israel faced tough questions on Capitol Hill. Mike Huckabee is a Baptist minister and former governor of Arkansas who has a long history with Israel, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Thank you very, very much for giving me the privilege of coming.
The protests began just as Mike Huckabee started his opening remarks. The former Arkansas governor smiled through the repeated protests and talked about his deep ties to Israel. He says he first went there 52 years ago, and in recent decades, he's led over 100 religious tours, adding that many American churches have connections to Israel.
We ultimately are people of the book. We believe the Bible. And therefore, that connection is not geopolitical. It is also spiritual.
Huckabee often uses biblical terms when talking about Israel, referring to the occupied Palestinian West Bank as Judea and Samaria, and supporting the right-wing Israeli efforts to annex land that Palestinians want as their future state. Senator Jeff Merkley, an Oregon Democrat, pressed him on that.
Have you previously supported the idea of annexation of the West Bank?
I have previously supported it, yes, sir, Judea and Samaria, but it would not be my prerogative to make that the policy of the president.
Yeah. Do you support the annexation of Gaza as well?
Senator, once again, it would be the prerogative of the president.
Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen called Huckabee a big hero of the Israeli settler movement, while Nevada Senator Jackie Rosen pressed him on whether the U.S. should continue to support the idea of two states for two people, Israelis and Palestinians. Huckabee says Israel is a tiny country, while Muslim countries control much more land.
I think the question is not, is there a need for people who are Palestinian to be able to live and have a future? The question is where and when. Where will that be? Will it be on top of the Israeli Jewish state?
Or somewhere else, he wondered. On Gaza, Huckabee says President Trump does not want to force Palestinians to leave, but he thinks it would be better if they do so that the territory can be rebuilt after the war ends. He says Hamas has no future there. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Many residents here in Los Angeles are starting to rebuild after the wildfires in January destroyed thousands of homes. Government officials often face pressure to loosen building regulations after disasters. But in LA, the rules are getting tougher for more than 500 homeowners who will have to make their houses more resistant to future fires. Lauren Sommer has more from NPR's Climate Desk.
When Patrick and Ruth Fong look at the debris pile that used to be their home, they see all the places their kids used to play.
That's our kids' bikes out front, all rusted and burned up.
Basketball hoops.
You see our little.
There's a charred ring of metal in the backyard that used to be a trampoline.
Yeah, so this is the only house our kids remember.
It burned in the Eaton Fire, which hit Altadena in January. For the first time, though, the Fongs are starting to picture what could be here in the future.
Yeah, we actually just met with our contractor today to finalize the floor plan for what things will look like.
Right after the fire, Patrick says they weren't sure they wanted to keep living here. This is the second time a wildfire has hit this property. It also burned in 1993 before they owned it.
we had in our heads, oh my gosh, we have to build it and then sell it because what if it happens again, or, you know, all these terrible things that we're thinking about.
But they love their neighbors. So now they're asking their contractor how to rebuild a house that's safer. That could mean using fire-resistant materials, like a roof or siding that won't ignite as easily. But they're also thinking about the cost.
With fireproof construction, how much more is that going to be? And how much can we really afford? Because, I mean, we're already maxing out our policy for this.
Some homeowners rebuilding in Los Angeles will have to use fire-resistant materials. That's because California is one of the few states that has building codes that require it in areas at risk. Right now, the Fongs aren't considered to be in one of those risky areas, so they don't have to rebuild with wildfire codes. It's based on state maps. But for some homeowners, that will change in just a few months.
So our maps for LA County are coming out. There's a lot of trepidation from many folks.
Amy Bodak is the director of regional planning for the County of Los Angeles. She says the state determines where wildfire building codes apply. Under the new maps, more than 500 properties in the Eaton Fire burn area now will have to use them, according to an analysis by NPR. Bodak says that aligns with how Los Angeles County is trying to make communities safer from wildfires.
Certainly not going to prevent the disasters. How can we minimize strategically the harm to individuals and to properties?
The new wildfire zones must be adopted by the end of July. That puts some homeowners in a tricky spot. If they can get a building permit approved before then they don't have to use wildfire-resistant materials. And the majority of buildings in the Eaton Fire burn area, almost 8,000, won't have to use wildfire building codes either because they're still not in a designated wildfire zone. Wildfire experts say it's important that every house there is constructed to resist wildfires. Kimiko Barrett is a wildfire researcher at Headwaters Economics, a nonprofit research group.
If homes are being rebuilt, they should be rebuilt with wildfire in mind, because unfortunately we do know that risks are increasing. History repeats itself. This will not be the only time that LA experiences a catastrophic wildfire.
Barrett says studies show that using wildfire-resistant materials has helped save homes during wildfires. That's because a lot of homes ignite from tiny embers blown by the wind. So you want building materials that resist them. And they're not hard to find.
These are often materials commonly used on the market, widely available. Things like asphalt roofs, things like hardy plank, fiber cement siding, very, very common, very affordable.
Overall, it can add just 2% to the cost of construction at the low end, she says, or at the high end, adds around 10% if you use something like an all-metal roof. The power of mandatory building codes, she says, is that they make entire neighborhoods safer. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Soon after President Trump's inauguration in January, several federal government webpages vanished. Many of them came back online with changes made to comply with the new administration's policies. As government resources disappear or change entirely, many people are turning to the Internet Archive. It's a digital library that backs up the World Wide Web. NPR's Emma Bowman went to the archive's headquarters in San Francisco to meet the team trying to save the world's digital history.
The Internet Archive is housed in a building that used to be a church, and where its congregation once sat, visitors are greeted by a loud humming noise. Its source? Tall black stacks of computer servers.
That is the Internet Archive. So when the lights are blinking, that means that something's being written to or read from those hard drives.
That's Mark Graham, the director of the Wayback Machine, the part of the Internet Archive where people can access three decades of Internet history. He's taking about a dozen visitors on a tour of the place. In recent weeks, Graham's team and its servers have been working overtime.
I've been finding myself, quite literally, since the inauguration, waking up earlier.
He says the Internet Archive has saved about 73,000 government web pages that went offline after Trump's return to the White House. Brewster Kahle founded the Internet Archive back in 1996. He says the takedowns are drawing many more people to its services.
People are coming and rallying behind by using it, by pointing at things, helping organize things, submitting content to be archived.
The archive's race to save web pages lost or changed under the Trump administration is part of the group's bigger battle against an enemy called link rot. Page not found or error 404, that's link rot. The work is most evident on Wikipedia, where the archive has fixed over 23 million rotten links. That's something that's on the mind of Avinash Krishna, a recent college grad with a computer science degree who's on the tour of the building.
Now, a significant percentage of Wikipedia links are like Internet Archive links. That is like really sad that, you know, what people view as a primary source is something that doesn't exist anymore.
As the archive does what it can to make sure the web doesn't collapse from broken links, the organization is facing its own set of challenges. Kahle says that right now, copyright lawsuits pose a big danger to the nonprofit. Apart from web pages, the Internet Archive also stores digitized books, and publishers are suing the Internet Archive for hundreds of millions of dollars. Even at a time when the Internet Archive is under threat, Kahle appreciates that back at the headquarters, the towering servers remain out in the open, in full public view.
It's not hidden away in some bunker someplace. You know, it comes across as a bit vulnerable.
He thinks this vulnerability sends a message that institutions like the Internet Archive need protection, or they too are at risk of vanishing. Emma Bowman, NPR News, San Francisco.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
Some describe it as skunky. Some say it's gassy. Yes, we are talking about the smell of weed. But in recent years, that skunky aroma of yore has diversified into a variety of cannabis strains with their own scent profiles. For our series, How Safe Is Your Weed?, NPR's Ping Wong stopped to smell the marijuana buds being grown in Western Maryland.
Just off the highway in Hagerstown, there's a big warehouse and greenhouse compound locked behind barbed wire gates. It's the grow facility for District Cannabis, which sells weed in Washington, D.C. and Maryland. Andras Kirshner is the founder and head grower.
That's our grow facility. It's our weed factory. It's a dream come true.
This weed factory produces 15,000 pounds of cannabis flower each year.
It's a lot of weed.
We get suited up to take a tour.
Jacket, we should get you a lab coat.
Sweet.
And then we're going to have to put your shoes in a little wrap to protect the plants.
We walk into a warm, humid room filled with 1,500 cannabis plants, flowers in bloom, about 5 days from harvest.
Squeeze it a little bit, and then you get the essence in your fingers.
Kirshner won the Grand Champion title last year in a competition with weed growers from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. The winning strain was called Layer Cake. This one here is a cousin to it called Gelato Cake. Kyle Pearl, the general manager of operations here, describes the smell.
So this is definitely one of our more complex profiles. Its dominant terpenes are caryophyllene, limonene, and linalool.
Let's start by explaining terpenes. These are chemical compounds found in a lot of plants, like herbs and citrus and pine trees. And in cannabis, they're largely responsible for the different smells and flavors in the plants. With Gelato Cake, Pearl says those terpenes are giving sweetness and grapes with cognac on the finish, and some notes of kerosene, or as Kirshner calls it, gas.
It was what a lot of the breeders wanted when they started breeding cannabis. And so a lot of the strains started to really exhibit that skunk smell.
Pamela Dalton is a smell scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center, a nonprofit research institute. She says that classic weed scent used to be attributed to a skunky terpene, but in the past few years, research has pointed to a different culprit.
And they found out that it was actually a sulfur compound, which, to my way of thinking, would absolutely be what would be responsible for a sulfur odor, right? The smell of skunk spray or anything like that.
It's the sulfur note mixed with the fresher smelling terpenes that gives weed its signature smells. Dalton says in some strains, that skunk note dominates.
We are extremely sensitive to sulfur compounds. So if you have a range of compounds in your cannabis, it's likely that what you're going to smell first are the sulfur compounds.
Dalton says there's been a trend in cannabis cultivation towards new strains and hybrids that are more pleasant to more people.
I'm almost 70 years old, and the cannabis I smelled when I was 13, 14, 15 smelled way skunkier than anything that I experience now.
Back at the grow farm, we walk from room to room through the production process. Pearl, the general manager, points out a strain called Pave flowering in the greenhouse.
It's an overwhelmingly kind of cushy, earthy, it's almost a little minty, a little spearminty.
There are stalks of cherry limeade hung upside down to cure in a cold room. In the trim room, Kirshner says they're trimming up a new hybrid called Barry Payton.
It is a tropical runts times Gary Payton. Those are the parents. You can definitely smell the fruity profile.
Every room smells like a different combination of musky, fruity gas. But nobody buys weed just to smell it.
This room's gonna be a little loud. We've got a lot of machines firing off in this space.
The weed grown here is destined for the local market. Kirshner says some of it gets packaged and sold as flower or extracted for edibles and vapes or pre-rolled into joints.
We have a machine here that is automated and can make 4 million pre-rolls in a year. We're currently not selling that many, but we can make them.
In Maryland, where cannabis is allowed for recreational use, consumers have spent more than $180 million on cannabis products in the first 2 months of the year. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Lollapalooza defined what rock would become in the early 90s, with bands such as Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Green Day performing on their main stage. Today, well, it's just not something that could be put together quite easily.
A festival like this that would tour around the country with this many artists of that stature is actually impossible to do.
The history of Lollapalooza on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The new novel, Tilt, imagines a day in the aftermath of a massive earthquake that devastates the Pacific Northwest.
I was so interested in the idea of what it feels like to live under the shadow of something coming. And everyone keeps telling you to get prepared.
Our conversation with author Emma Patti, First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, President Trump's pick to head the Social Security Administration went before the Senate Finance Committee today. The tech CEO took questions about long wait times as well as the ongoing influence of DOGE on the agency. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
Frank Bisignano fielded questions about a host of problems facing the Social Security Administration. That includes office closures, wait times for phone services, and staffing shortfalls. Democratic senators also pressed the nominee on the role of billionaire Elon Musk's team known as DOGE at the agency. Bisignano told lawmakers he thinks current problems at the Social Security Administration stem from the interim commissioner who has been working closely with Musk's team.
So I don't know if this is a DOGE issue. I think we have a leadership issue.
Democratic senators argued during the hearing that much of the recent chaos at the agency has been created by Musk in particular. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Well, after a meeting with United Nations officials, Syria's new government says it's redoubling efforts to investigate mass killings of minorities. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Damascus.
Government spokesperson Yasser Farhan told reporters that investigators are collecting witness testimony about what human rights groups have called revenge massacres against Alawites, who are from the same offshoot sect of Islam as the deposed President Bashar al-Assad. But he said many people are still too scared to come forward. Survivors of these attacks have told NPR that some of the assailants wore government uniforms. Many of them don't trust the authorities to prosecute them. Human rights groups say anywhere from 600 to 1,600 people were killed in Alawite areas over the course of about a week earlier this month, and that thousands remain missing. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Damascus.
On Wall Street, stocks edged slightly higher today. This is NPR. In New York City, a production of Shakespeare's Othello, starring Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal, opened this week with many tickets going for over $900. But as Jeff London tells us, some students will be able to see it for considerably less.
On Tuesday, the producers of Othello on Broadway announced that about 2,000 New York area school kids will be seeing the hottest show in town for free because of a partnership with the New York Department of Education, the Boys and Girls Clubs of America, and several anonymous donors. In addition, a limited number of $49 student rush tickets will be available for each performance. With tickets that top out at $921, Othello has been setting box office records for a play. Last week, it took in over $2.5 million. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Well, Tesla sales are taking a hit globally as well, down 49% in the first 2 months of this year in Europe, even as the EU electric vehicle market grows. Complaints about Tesla's aging lineup of vehicles and backlash against CEO Elon Musk and his ties to the Trump administration have been escalating. Back in January, Tesla posted its first annual sales drop in more than a dozen years. Stocks finished slightly higher today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. European security officials have reacted cautiously to the revelation that the Trump administration accidentally included a journalist on a text chat discussing details of a military operation in Yemen. As Willem Marx reports from London, reactions have been varied, but many in Europe admit the incident only underlines the fraying of transatlantic relations.
The UK is America's closest ally for intelligence sharing and has played a small, significant role in operations against Houthi forces in Yemen at the center of the recent revelations from journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. So it was unsurprising British politicians fielded thorny inquiries about the security lapse, including UK Minister for the Armed Forces Luke Pollard, who faced repeated questions in Parliament. One lawmaker asked what would happen to UK officials if they shared sensitive military details in a similar fashion. Here's Pollard's response.
My general rule would be that if there's operational decisions that are being taken, we should all, regardless of our role within defence, take our information sharing seriously, and there would be a clear consequence and a disciplinary process for anyone that wouldn't be following those procedures.
It's not acceptable, is it?
The UK's Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, avoided any undiplomatic language when she was repeatedly pressed on the topic in a BBC interview.
We've been sharing intelligence and information for many decades, and we continue to do that through our secure networks. It is for the US and the US President and the government to explain and decide what they're doing in regards to their security and that signal messaging group.
Across Europe, the focus has been on the Trump administration's sometimes scornful attitude towards European defence capabilities, as Germany's most read newspaper, Das Bild, reported in its audio version. Aside from the laxity with which the world's most powerful politician shared top-secret military strikes in an unsecured chat group, a reporter from Das Bild wrote, the unfriendly words towards Europe from the Americans are further proof that the US no longer considers us a vital ally. But Europe should not be surprised, said Pierre Aski, an editorial writer speaking on French public radio. For Europeans, there's a sense of a broken relationship in discovering the extent of American hostility, Aski said. But like in love, there is life after a breakup, and it's important to make the most of your new life. There was some satisfaction at the lapse, too, including in the audio version of Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera. We can't have someone in the Oval Office who doesn't understand the meaning of the word classified, the newspaper quoted President Trump as saying during the 2016 presidential election campaign. Then it showcased his opponent in that race, Hillary Clinton, reacting this week on social media, you've got to be kidding. The breakdown in transatlantic ties, the messages reveal, is troubling, though, says Ian Lesser, a distinguished fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States think tank.
It's really unprecedented. And these are not challenges the European institutions are well set up to deal with. Perhaps individual leaders in Europe will react, you know, in different ways to it. But Brussels itself, the European Union itself, NATO certainly, with the US as part of it, is simply not well set up to address this multifaceted challenge.
As European governments step up the defence spending, many in Europe say their militaries must soon be more ready to operate without US help. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
And a note that NPR's CEO Catherine Marr is chair of the board of Signal Foundation, which runs the Signal messaging app.
The first weekend of the women's NCAA basketball tournament has come and gone without major upsets, but many fans are upset that the country's consensus player of the year, Juju Watkins, suffered a season-ending knee injury yesterday. Her number one seeded USC team still won. They continue to the Sweet 16, where 15 other teams are still hoping to bust a bracket or two. Nicole Auerbach's bracket is doing just fine for now. She's NBC Sports Insider. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I mean, Nicole, so many people's hearts are just broken after that Juju Watkins injury. Am I wrong to say that that's the biggest headline of the tournament so far? And how big of a loss is this for her team, for the tournament as a whole?
Yeah, it feels like it sucked the wind out of the entire tournament. I mean, it feels like these are going to be dark clouds that hang over the rest of the way because of what a bright light she is. I mean, she's in all the commercials in between the game action. I mean, she is such a star. And it's so upsetting to not get to see her have this moment and this chance. It felt like she'd taken that baton from Caitlin Clark and was the face of the sport. And these USC Trojans trying to make history and cut down the nets. And it's going to be hard to watch the rest of the tournament and think about the rest of the tournament without thinking about this injury.
So with Juju Watkins' injury, that really deprives us of a potential sort of collision between her and UConn's Paige Beckers in the Elite Eight, or with star center Lauren Betts from crosstown rivals UCLA in the Final Four. So I just want to ask you, what teams have impressed you so far, and who's really set up to take advantage of this really unfortunate power vacuum?
Well, I do think UConn is positioned to be that team because of, as you mentioned, that they were in line to meet them in the Elite Eight. And I remember on Selection Sunday thinking that that was unfortunate that some of these stars were going to meet so early in the tournament. But now it certainly paves the way for UConn to get to the Final Four in Paige's last season and cap off the season there with, you know, the championship DNA of that program, giving them a good shot to cut down the nets at the end. I also think Notre Dame in a different region has been playing extremely well. They slumped a little bit heading into Selection Sunday, but they look like the team that reached number one in the AP poll earlier this season. So would not be surprised to see them in Tampa as well.
All right. So before we get there, play resumes on Friday. When you're looking ahead to the next round, what's the most intriguing matchup that you're watching?
Well, we're going to get a North Carolina Duke game, and no matter what sport, no matter what gender, that is always interesting. And so we'll get that on Friday out of the Birmingham site. So I'm excited for that because I think this Duke team led by Kara Lawson is really peaking. They won the ACC tournament for the first time in more than a decade. And I am fascinated by how far she can take this particular team just 5 years into this job.
All right. So here's a question I've got for you. I live in Maryland. I watched that double overtime game. And I know that they're going up against South Carolina coming up. And I know in your predictions, you did not have the defending national champion South Carolina advancing. Tell me more about that. I might be stirring the pot a little bit, but where do you see them as vulnerable?
Well, I just think that this is a year where it wasn't South Carolina versus the field, and that there are 6, 7, maybe 8 teams you could have made a case to win it all. To me, that means that there is a chance that South Carolina doesn't get to Tampa and gets beaten along the way. That Maryland team is so interesting to me. I think that that game would have been the moment of the tournament. So I think they're capable of pushing them. I think there's other teams in the region that could do it, or at the Final Four.
Last year, when we talked about women's college basketball, there was sort of this one big story that subsumed everything, which was Caitlin Clark breaking the college scoring record. What does the energy look like around the tournament this year now that she's gone pro?
Well, I was interested to see if there would be like a significant drop off in interest, and I really don't think there has been. I mean, I don't think you're going to see like the record numbers of viewership, but you already are seeing that people stuck around who were introduced to the sport in recent years, and they are more familiar with the household names like Juju. Unfortunately, she's out for the rest of the way, but Paige and Hannah Hidalgo at Notre Dame, Madison Booker at Texas. Like, there are stars that have stepped into that void that people have gotten to know and learn. It's going to be very different without Caitlin, but I think what people are being exposed to are greatness in a number of different programs with a number of different coaches and new stars, but with the same high quality level of play.
Nicole Auerbach covers college athletics for NBC Sports. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has promised tariffs on Mexico and Canada, but the United States actually made a trade deal with its neighbors during Trump's first term. So what's the deal with that deal? NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid reports.
The other day, I swung by an international trade conference here in Washington. Lawyers from major American companies spoke about the erratic economic environment they are trying to navigate these days. One of the guys joked about a recurring dream where he's running down a hill and all of a sudden a Harley Davidson flies by, then Jack Daniels bottles and Levi's jeans. It was a reference to the popular American products facing potential retaliation for Trump tariffs. The crowd chuckled nervously because they are tariff experts. They're people like Eduardo Diaz.
I am a trade lawyer. I'm based in Mexico City, and I specialized in trade, customs, and international agreements.
In his view, the threat of tariffs on a whole bunch of Mexican and Canadian products undermines the very reason for having a free trade deal.
What we're looking at now is not normal. Once you have a trade deal, you're not supposed to go back on the deal. And this is what's actually happening now.
And what makes this moment all the more confusing is that this existing deal, known as USMCA, was not crafted under Democrats. Trump made this deal to replace NAFTA, which was signed in the early 1990s. Take a listen to what he had to say when he signed the agreement in the summer of 2020.
Today, we're finally ending the NAFTA nightmare and signing into law the brand new US-Mexico-Canada agreement. Very special. Very, very special.
He said it was a partnership with Mexico and Canada. And even during his recent re-election campaign last fall, he referred to it as the best trade deal ever made, they say. Trade experts say it was supposed to allow the three countries to work together. But Matthew Holmes with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce says it seems like the Trump administration is walking away from the deal.
I have never in my lifetime seen response I'm seeing in Canada right now towards the United States, and it's very negative.
His chamber represents some 200,000 Canadian businesses. Holmes says if these tariffs are a negotiation tactic by the American president, it seems like an unwise strategy.
What I say to that is rip up our trade agreement once, shame on you. Rip it up twice, shame on me. I don't think we move into a third renegotiated agreement with any sort of certainty or expectation that the United States can be trusted moving forward.
The existing deal is pretty clear. No new widespread tariffs. But it does allow exceptions for national security. And in theory, that is President Trump's justification for these new tariffs. He points to illegal immigration and illicit drugs coming across the border. But he's also sending mixed messages. In a recent interview with Laura Ingraham on Fox News, he accused Canada of cheating on the deal.
Got them there, and USMCA is good, but they cheat. You know, an agreement's good, but they cheat. And Mexico cheats also.
But China cheated.
A White House official who was not authorized to speak publicly about policy told NPR the world has changed since USMCA went into effect and said China has been trying to bypass tariffs using Mexico as a middleman for Chinese steel. Frankly, that concern about China is somewhat bipartisan. But the question is, how do you deal with that problem? For now, it seems Trump's strategy is tariff first and then maybe reach a trade deal later. USMCA is set to be reviewed next year. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The opening chapters of Emma Patti's debut novel introduce us to Annie. Now, Annie is massively pregnant, 37 weeks. She's shopping at IKEA in Portland, Oregon, trying to wrestle a baby crib off the rack when everything starts to shake. It's an earthquake, the big one. The lights go out, phone lines go down, her car keys are lost, and so she starts to walk. The novel is titled Tilt, and Emma Patti is here now. Hey.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I gather the initial inspiration, at least, was you, that when you were very pregnant, you went shopping for a crib at the Portland IKEA and the ground started to shake?
Yeah, I was so scared of the earthquake at that point that as soon as the building started to shake, I thought, oh, it's the big one. It was not the big one. It was a large truck coming by. But as soon as I realized that it wasn't, the idea for the book was almost fully formed in my mind.
It was all like, well, what if and what would you do?
Absolutely. And the idea of the walk home, that I would have no choice but to walk, even massively pregnant.
Oh. Just to reiterate, your protagonist, Annie, she is crib shopping at 37 weeks, and even she concedes that this is an errand she should have gotten done a lot earlier. Introduce us a little bit more fully to Annie, your main character, because she is deeply ambivalent about a lot of things, including the fact that she's pregnant.
Yeah, you know, Annie, I think, is very stuck. And I think she's also having what I consider to be sort of a millennial experience of, I thought that my 30s would look different than this. I thought my life was going to turn out different than it did. And I feel a sense of disappointment and missed potential that I cannot shake. Mm. And that is sort of getting in the way of me being able to even appreciate what I do have or what is still possible.
Do you think that's really unique to millennials? I'm a Gen Xer and I felt that, and I'm not sure it's unique to my 30s either.
You know, the more people who read this book, the more it becomes clear that it is not unique to millennials. You know, I think what I wanted to show was kind of the ways in which Annie's sort of artistic ambition ran into some really real roadblocks, like the recession, like what has happened in Portland with changing prices and the tech boom. You know, Annie's life has been really impacted by the pandemic, and her life is once again being impacted by a force completely outside of her control. But I definitely appreciate the pushback, because it has become clear to me that I think everyone has a little bit of this feeling, and that there's a universality to Annie's story.
I had in my head as I read this, I kept thinking of the classics of ancient Greek epics. On the one hand, you couldn't be farther removed. This is set in modern day. You're on the west coast of the United States. You're at an IKEA, for God's sake. On the other hand, you have this epic odyssey and this fight for survival. And without giving anything away, Annie pulls off feats of superhuman strength as the plot unfolds.
Yes, I was very interested, sort of structurally, in the idea of an epic quest and a journey. At one point early on writing this, was sort of looking at the way that Don Quixote is structured. Mm. Somebody who is on a journey and they don't exactly know what they're going to encounter, but they end up somewhere geographically different than where they started, but also changed in a way that can never be undone.
That's interesting. Explain that a little bit more fully, changing in a way that can never be undone.
Well, I think I started to become really interested in this idea of shock points, like these moments in your life where everything gets rattled and you all of a sudden can see things clearly. And I became really interested in stories people would tell about after 9/11. You know, a lot of people on 9/11 were not maybe in life or death situations, but felt completely rattled and still had to walk home, and it took hours. And I have met many people who told me, oh, on that walk, I realized I was going to get divorced. On that walk, I decided I was done working that job. It gave this moment where you can make a different decision. And that's what I wanted to give to Annie. You know, she is so disappointed in her life. She's disappointed by her ambitions. She feels completely isolated and has kind of lost the awe, the incredible kind of beauty of being alive. And I wanted to give her the chance to change her life.
So at the center of the book, again, is an earthquake. And I read that you wanted to be absolutely as scientifically accurate about how you wrote it as possible, about the severity of the shaking and what the exact impact on the failure of the power grid might be. I'm curious why. It's fiction. You could just make it all up.
Well, so yeah, here in the Pacific Northwest, we're waiting on this massive earthquake. And scientists predict that there's a 37% chance it will happen in the next 50 years. And that when it does, it'll be one of the worst natural disasters in the recorded history of North America. So at night, when I'm lying in bed, you know, that plays out in my mind. And I wrote this book because I was starting to crack living with the fear of this. And I think I wanted to know, well, what would really happen? I wanted to resolve my own anxiety. And in doing so, have now made many, many other people very anxious. sorry for that. And truly, actually, I hear from a lot of people that the book has relieved their earthquake anxiety and has really grounded their fears in a reality. So it was very important to me that the book be scientifically accurate. And I did research sort of every element, not only of the earthquake, but also of how it would impact the city of Portland, of the bridges. Even I pulled the building plans for the IKEA building. So I tried to make every element of this book as much like a nonfiction book as I could. Having said that, it is a fiction book, and this is an earthquake that has not yet happened.
And why on that? Because you're a climate journalist. Why not write a nonfiction book about the big one? Why write a novel?
Well, there's been an incredible nonfiction book already written about the earthquake, and one that I relied on heavily. It's called Rip 9.0 by Sandy Dotton. But a nonfiction book cannot imagine the future. You really do need fiction for that. And because I am a climate journalist, I was so interested in the idea of what it feels like to live under the shadow of something coming that is so big you can't even imagine it. And everyone keeps telling you to get prepared, but how do you prepare for that? And we have these busy lives. We have kids to pick up. We have groceries. We have, you know, political disasters unfolding. What does it really mean to prepare?
That's a great point. Like, what was Annie supposed to do other than walk around with, I don't know, a backpack on every day with bottled water and backup cell phone and
never leave her house? Exactly. Like, when I started writing this book, I think I had so much anger about the people in my life and the people I was meeting who didn't care about climate change and who weren't mobilizing around climate change. And writing this book and getting to really understand Annie, I really found compassion for the parts of our brain that just cannot grapple with things that are this large and this terrifying.
Emma Patti, her utterly gripping new novel is Tilt. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hope.